Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 164, which is the first of a two-part episode on ants with Dr. Christine Sosiak of the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. So this episode came as a request from Pablo, and so it goes to show that we'll always try to do what we can to make your suggested interviews happen. So please feel free to drop us a message, and if you've already done so, then just know that we have some of your requested subjects already scripted and awaiting their recording dates. I hope that you'll agree with me that this episode is another of the classics, where we have a very knowledgeable and engaging guest who's able to share a lot of information about a group that most of us would have given very little thought to. So in this first part, we're going to be covering the basics, as well as unlearning some of the common misconceptions about what ants are. And in the second part, we'll be examining their fossil record to see how they fared throughout their evolutionary history. Now, before anyone starts raging in the comments, and I am speaking directly to you lot on YouTube, we are not fully on topic for the first 10 minutes or so, so please feel free to skip ahead to around 12 minutes or something. Sometimes we cut this kind of stuff out, but there is still plenty of ant information and insights amongst all the chatting that it would have been a shame to have lost. Conversely, if you listen and you do really like my ant pun, that is a comment worthy of sharing, and please do so. And as always, if you visit our website, you'll find the images that accompany this episode, so you can see many of the ants that Christine mentions, as well as graphical representations of some of the concepts we discuss. And if you enjoy this episode, please help us reach new audiences by engaging with our posts on social media, especially our new Blue Sky account, as we aim to build that up. And of course, I wish you all a very pleasant listening experience. Hi, Christine. Thank you very much for coming onto the show today. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's get to know you a little bit first. What was your route into paleontology?
So my route into paleontology, I actually started in entomology first. So I actually started my undergraduate degree thinking I was going to be a lawyer and ended up not doing that. I took an introductory course in biology and I thought, hey, this is really neat. And then after a couple of years of taking more biology courses, I took a course that was a field course actually in the Canadian Rocky Mountains, and it was 2 weeks of just collecting bugs. And I thought, this is amazing. I just want to kind of do this for the rest of my life. And so started doing the bugs.
I can imagine that conversation with your parents. They're going, oh, how's the law degree going? What kind of modules are you doing? And you're just like, it's kind of getting a bit more insecty at the minute.
A lot more legs are getting involved here. Yeah. No, actually, when I said I wanted to do law, my dad came out with a joke, and maybe you're going to have to cut this joke, but he goes, what do you call 200 dead lawyers at the bottom of the sea? A good start. And I was like, well, Dad, I want to be a lawyer. And of course, now I'm not. So he can tell that joke all he wants. But I think they were happy, actually, that they switched to entomology.
It is a classic dad joke.
Yeah.
As a little aside, my dad is an actual comedian.
Does he tell the logic?
I will pass it on, and he can decide.
You can tell him it's related to entomology in a really zigzag way.
I was thinking about this. You know, like, if anyone's curious about whether or not they want to try any, like, insect puns, I would say, mandible a bit. Mandible.
I'm so angry right now.
Anyway, that's my life, living with dad jokes.
It's too funny, actually, because my husband is just like, he's made of 90% puns. Oh. And so literally any single time I'll be talking to him about anything in my life, but definitely science, and it will become a pun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, he, I'm not even going to tell him about that pun because he would love it so much. And that would just be my life for the next 50 years is just hearing that.
He's not around, is he? He couldn't come on the podcast, then we'll just do a load of puns.
No, he's actually in Canada, but you could definitely call him up and he'd be happy to do a podcast just full of paleontology puns for an hour.
Oh,
he would
excellent.
He would be thrilled.
I guess it's so easy to do ant puns as well, because all the words that end in ant.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a lot. And actually, it's the main reason why, like, so when I describe fossil species, I actually usually end up asking him to name them, because he's good at puns, but he's also just like kind of good at like, yeah, I guess there's like a sort of relationship between being good at puns and also like kind of thinking creatively and outside the box. And so I'll show him the specimen and I'll say, okay, here's the context. Here's a little bit of information about it. Please give me an ant name. And he will. So.
That must be so weird. Like you're just, is he just like a regular guy?
Yeah. He's not an entomologist. He's just.
You just get drawn into naming a load of fossil ants.
Exactly. I don't think it was what he imagined for himself when he was a child, but.
Well, yeah. Anyway, that's a huge aside. I don't know how much of that is actually going to go in, but I had fun.
I'm glad. Maybe I could go in at the end. It was a good aside. Do you have like a blooper reel?
Well, we do today. yeah, I mean, sometimes it just goes in. Other times, I drop the puns in and nobody notices and nobody mentions them. And I'm just like, has nobody seen, like the interviewee hasn't picked up on it and no one in the audience has commented on it. It just goes out there. And I like the idea that, you know, this the podcast is so full of obscure puns that are delivered so deadpan, and I'm just like, I don't think anyone knows they exist. And I kind of like that they're just waiting there for someone.
I think that's the big draw of puns, you know? It's just, like, entirely deadpan. They just, like, sneak up on you. Like, 5 minutes later, you're like...
Oh, God. Like, we can't put this in case your husband listens and he knows that you actually like his puns.
Yeah, he can't be aware of that. He cannot know that fact.
No. Yeah. Right. how do we get back into this now?
I guess...
It's so far gone.
So far gone, yeah. Well, I was talking about how I started in entomology.
Mm.
Yeah, so I got into entomology. I did some undergraduate research with a prof who taught that class. And I started studying ants just because, you know, they're so incredibly diverse and I hadn't really realized that. And I think most people don't. Because you sort of see ants everywhere in your day to day, but you don't necessarily get a chance to look at them close up, which is where you see a good chunk of that diversity, and B, to really see all of the different species, especially if you're living in like kind of a colder environment, like I was in Canada. So you're not seeing like any of the really cool, weird ones.
Don't tell us about those yet. That's coming later in the episode. We want to know about you.
Yeah, okay. So I'll stop talking about ants. I'll talk about myself. I was interested in fossils from a very young age because I grew up in Alberta, of course. And so, like, I grew up going to the Terrell on weekends with my family. And so I told my professor, I was like, I'm really interested in fossils and entomology. So, like, paleoentomology, I'm really interested in. And he said, well, do you want to eat? Because there's really no careers for that. And I was like, okay, that's fair enough.
Wow.
And I mean, you know, he wasn't that wrong. It's a very, very niche area to work in.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was very lucky that when I started looking around for grad school, I found somebody who actually studies fossil ants, like one of the three people in the world, basically, who do so. And he was taking students that year. So the rest of that is just kind of history.
Yeah, and so what do you reckon you'd be doing if you weren't a paleontologist? A lawyer?
I mean, maybe I would have been a lawyer. I started a catering company when I was in my mid-teens, so I think that's probably what I would have ended up doing.
Like what? Like baking or?
Baking. I started doing baking, and then like people started asking me. Like basically, I started just making cookies, and people started asking me for the cookies on a regular basis. To the point where I was like, okay, well, I gotta charge you for ingredients at least.
Mm.
And then I started charging them for my time as well, and then it just sort of snowballed. And Whoa. Then I started like cooking like meals for groups of like up to around 30 people, and it was great. It was a lot of fun, but it ended up becoming this thing where it was like, because catering is a very stressful job. Cooking is a very stressful job. It has to be perfect.
Yeah.
And so I thought like, this is way too stressful. And then I went into academia instead, which was a mistake.
All of this focus on everything being perfect and correct is just too much in catering. Let's go to academia.
Exactly. I thought, oh, this won't be so stressful.
Yeah. No one's going to complain if the slightest little thing is wrong. No one's ever going to pick me up on that.
Nobody's going to spend hours and hours just trying to tear apart my work with a fine-tooth comb. Like...
Wow, I've never had that. Never had that answer.
That's a new thing for paleontologists.
So, okay, a little crossover here. Have you ever eaten an ant?
Like not intentionally. I've definitely eaten some ants on accident.
Well, there's a story developing here.
I mean, I've eaten other insects on purpose. So like cicadas, crickets and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And they're very good. But I've always wanted to try in Central and South America, leaf cutter ant queens are considered a delicacy. They're supposedly very delicious, and I just have never gotten a chance to try them. So I'd happily eat an ant, but...
I think... Eating an ant, a singular regular worker ant, it's just like one of thousands. Eating the queen is quite the insult to the colony. Like there's thousands more to choose from, and you'd like, no, I want the main one.
No, see, actually, it's quite different. So this is, I'm going to have to talk about ants here a little bit more.
All right, okay, but, if you so have there to.
Part of the reproductive cycle of colonies is that you get a whole bunch of the queens and the males that are produced at the same time as other colonies. And then these queens and males are essentially, they leave the colony and often are winged, but not always. It depends on the species. For leafcutter ants, they are winged. And so they leave the colony and they go out in search of other queens and males from other colonies to mate with. And so when they're eating these are queens that have either not been mated or have just been mated and so actually haven't had a chance to start a colony yet. So you're preventing a colony from being formed, but you're not exactly destroying an entire colony for this.
All right, okay. Thank God, because I imagine someone like digging through a whole nest just trying to find that one tasty little... centimeter of food.
No, these ones you basically wander around with a net up in the air and you swoop them out.
Right, well, let's get into ants. So you were talking about some of the strange ones that we're not really exposed to. Like I'm somewhere as well that doesn't have a ridiculous amount of ant diversity. I know I've seen about three species of ant in my life. Well, that I know of, I've probably seen more, but they're still very anty. We all know what ants are. We know what they do. We know how they live. We know what they look like. We know how their society is structured and how that functions. So why is it that ants and possibly all social insects have this high profile where we all know what they are?
I think that there's several reasons why ants have such a high profile, and there's a great degree of familiarity, I would say, with ants. And also, to some extent, people know a lot less about ants than they think that they do. When I'm doing research and I start talking with people who, if I'm collecting in an area and people come by and start talking to me about what I'm doing, I often find that they have a lot of misconceptions about how ants work, how ant society functions, and that sort of thing. But I think first and foremost out of all of it is just because ants are so ubiquitous. Like, you know, you might, especially if you're in a northern area, you might go your entire life without seeing some species of beetles or some certain types of butterflies or moths. But pretty much everybody on the planet is always going to have seen an ant, and usually many, many, many ants. So I think that that's part of it. I think that another part of it is that humans have this sort of fascination with being social, social communities, social organisms, partially because we're social organisms. And so we think that that's like, you know, the superior thing to be with respect to biology. But seeing such a social organism and seeing organisms that are, in fact, even more social than we are in to some extent, I think that is something that's really fascinating to humans. And then I think the other, one of the other things, of course, is that because we spend a lot of time trying to defeat the ants, you know, they upturn our lawns or they infest our kitchens or they start eating out the walls of our houses and that sort of thing. And so we tend to be fascinated with something that we're in opposition to, especially if the ants usually seem to be winning, which often they are.
Another aside, I was thinking about dads and ants. It's just been Father's Day. And I think that dads can be separated into two groups depending on their reaction to ants.
Okay.
Because either they are absolutely fascinated. They'll get down, they'll watch them, they'll come up with a load of ant facts, or they'll be like, ants, where? And they'll be off to the garage, they'll get like petrol, concrete, everything to defeat them.
I mean, I could definitely believe it. Like, my dad was definitely, he's definitely in the latter group. Like, we had we had ants in the lawn for the longest time, and I mean, he spent years and years and years, and I think that they still have ants in the lawn. I don't think that they ever won. But by the time, like, I started studying ants, and my dad stopped at least doing it in front of me. He was like, I'm not trying to destroy the ants in the lawn. I was like, I see the raid there, Dad. I know what's going on here.
Does he use you as like a source of information? Like you're in the CIA or something?
Yes.
It's like, how do we kill them now? You've been researching this. Where is their weakness?
Absolutely. Everybody does. The single most common thing that I hear from anybody is like, oh, so what do you study? I say, I study ants. I work on ants. And the single most common response that I always get is, how do I kill the ants in my kitchen? And I'm like, no. I don't know. I don't know how to kill the ants in your kitchen. I don't know what species the ants are in your kitchen. I don't know anything about the ants in your kitchen. And I don't, you know, I don't work to kill the ants. I kind of like the ants. So
yeah, wow. That's surprising. And it's kind of a little bit sad, but I guess it's understandable because they're just ants to most people. And as you said, they're ubiquitous and they're also pests. So we can't have them having such a high profile on one hand and being universally loved on the other hand, or hated. Anyway.
It's hard. It's hard because, you know, it's like I say, like, I love these things so much. I've spent, you know, like, close to 15 years of my life working on this. And they're just like, yeah, kill them. Kill them. Kill stone dead. Like,
What would you like people to know about ants? If every ant hater was listening to this, and you could tell them something that just kind of like shows what kind of interesting creatures they are.
That's a great question. That's a great question. I think I would say to them that oftentimes ants are a mirror of ourselves, that they have accomplished so many of the things that we have accomplished. So, you know, social living, agriculture, you know, they invented agriculture millions of years before we did. Communal construction, communal care. And, you know, even sometimes like the bad things, there are ants that are kidnapper ants, social parasites that they go and basically steal the brood from other ant colonies. So the behavior of ants also mimics some very dark periods in our own history. And so there's something to be said about learning something about ourselves by also looking at the ants. And that's what I would say to someone who really hates ants, to try and get them to see insects from a perspective that's also similar to our own, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. I guess they are a good model to reflect on our own behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so kidnapper ants, farming ants, there is a lot of different ant kind of species and ecologies. How diverse and disparate are they? And what those terms mean is like what kind of like number of different species. That's the diversity, and the disparity is like the difference between them. If there's like loads and loads of species, but if they're all kind of the same, that's a low disparity. If everyone's completely different, then that's a high disparity.
Yeah, ants are incredibly diverse. So there's about 14,000 species of ants on the planet that we know of today, and probably several thousand more that are awaiting discovery and formal description. When it comes to the fossil record, actually, there's as many fossil species of ants as there are of dinosaurs. So kind of cool. And when we're thinking about disparity, it's actually really neat because ants really run the gamut of disparity. So there are some genera of ants where there are hundreds of species and they all look actually quite similar. So low disparity in these groups. But there are also tons and tons of ants that are extremely morphologically different from one another. So really long and leggy ants that have crazy long spiky mandibles, ants that have... one of my favorite, actually my favorite extant ant species is, it's called Melissotarsus, and they have, quite a few weird and wonderful adaptations. So they live in between, layers of bark in live trees, and they actually have their second pair of legs is articulated the other way so that they can walk in between these little cracks and crevices. And so if you take them out of the wood, they actually fall over. They can't walk on flat ground. They just have that. And they produce silk. So there are ants that produce silk just like spiders. The diversity of ants is just, it's shocking. And so is the size range as well. So you can get some very, really massive ants that are a few centimeters long and ants that you can barely see without a microscope. So there's a really famous photo of the smallest ant and the largest ant. And the smallest ant is just kind of a little speck on the largest ant's eye. And that's even before you get into the diversity and the disparity in different castes in ant society. So the same species, but different castes can look incredibly morphologically different, especially when it comes to the reproductive castes and the males versus the workers, or the major castes, which are more commonly known as like the soldier castes. They have completely different shapes of heads, completely different mandibles. So there's so many different shapes and forms of ants out there if you take the time to look.
Yeah, I think the castes are really interesting, especially if you're looking at the fossil record. Things that have different instars. And by that, it's like a different stage in their growth cycle. So an arthropod grows in stages because they molt. Sometimes in between those stages, you can change the whole shape of your body, but you're the same species. So if you look in the fossil record, how can you tell which is a juvenile of a crustacean and versus which is an adult when they look and they live completely differently? In ants, with the different castes and the different like societal roles, they can also look different. And so when you're looking in the fossil record, you might find a queen ant, you might find a soldier ant, you might find a worker ant or a male one, and they would appear to be different species. Like, it must be so hard to identify and to work with this problem that will always be there.
It's incredibly difficult, actually. And even with like extant ants, we often have this sort of like parallel taxonomy. So we have the males. So when it comes to ants, all the workers that you see are all females. And the females are non-reproductive. So in some situations, they can become like partially reproductive. If, say, for example, like if there are some species basically where the workers will engage in like ritualized combat to determine who becomes the queen. But in most ant species, the workers are pretty much sterile. And then you have the queens, which is the reproductive female caste. And then you have the males, which is basically their only role is reproduction. And so the males look entirely different from the females. And if you see a male ant, you would, the average person would not know that it's an ant. It kind of looks more like a wasp or a fly than anything. So they are typically winged, and they just like, they look completely different. You wouldn't recognize it. And so with a lot of species where they're cryptic, so they're hard to find, like they live subterranean or they're only in very specific areas, you tend to only find the males because they're the ones that are flying around and the ones that you catch. And so you end up describing the species just based off of the males, and then some species based just off of the workers. And you end up with this parallel taxonomy where it's like, okay, well, this male might actually be a male of some of these species that we have workers for. We just don't know for sure, because the only way that you can know is basically you get a colony right at the time when the males are about to leave for their called nuptial flights, the reproductive cycle. So when it comes to fossils, obviously that's even harder, because you're never, and maybe you might, but you're almost guaranteed not to find an entire fossilized colony. So sometimes the males look a little bit more like the workers, but it's very, very difficult to tell. And so usually you don't associate the males with the workers at all. And when it comes to the queens, there are some species where the queens look very similar to the workers, but there are some species where the queens are completely different. And so like it's really just, you have kind of have to go off of vibes. Like, does it look enough, similar enough? And then like indicators like fossil behavior and fossilized behavior and things like that.
A couple of things from that. I was just thinking then, you know, like the males, they still have their wings. They look different. Are the males then more representative of an ancestor that they evolved from? And you know, like males are what ants used to look like. And all of these females and the way that that all works, that's a specialist trait. Or is it the opposite way around, where the females, the queens, that's kind of like the normal, and that's what they've inherited, and then the males are just weird and specialist? Is that kind of thing been figured out, or am I just completely off the mark?
No, it's a great question, actually, and it gets to a really fundamental thought process about what the earliest ants would have looked like. So it is most, like, we think it's probably most likely that the males are representative of that ancestral state. So within wasps, parasitic wasps, which is the clade, parasitic wasps is a different clade from ants, but a parasitic wasp is likely kind of the ground plan that we can think of for what the earliest ants would have evolved from. And these often have situations where the female is wingless and the male is winged. So the males are the ones basically dispersing to find the females. So it could be that was kind of the ground plan of the earliest ants. Or it could be that the earliest ants had both winged females and males and slowly the females and the workers lost their wings over time, and the males retained them because it's easier for dispersal.
This is fascinating. I want to know everything about ants,
and it sounds so
like
I.
It would be so hard.
Yes.
Especially with what, like four of you now working on ants. You said that there's as many species as there are of dinosaurs. Like, is there just some professor just like, new ant, new ant, new ant, new ant?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah. Well, so there was actually a Russian professor, Dulesky, Dr. Dulesky, and he died in, I think, 2012 or something like that. But like half of the fossil ants in the world are Dulesky's.
Wow.
He just churned them out.
That's unbelievable. Right. You mentioned the parasitic wasps. Okay. So ants, parasitic wasps, normal wasps, bees, termites, are all of these social insects closely related?
Ooh, so complicated. It's a very complicated question for sure. So termites are an entirely separate group. So termites are actually most closely related to cockroaches. And based off of our understanding of cockroach evolution, basically termites are just a form of social cockroach, a very specialized form of social cockroach. So they, their evolution of eusociality occurred entirely separate from ants and bees and wasps. And it occurred much earlier, sometime in the Jurassic. When it comes to ants and bees and wasps, there were multiple origins, multiple independent origins of eusociality. So one origin of eusociality for ants, as far as we can tell, the earliest ancestor of ants was eusocial, and they've retained that eusociality all through 14,000 different species. And for bees, I think it's four or five different origins of eusociality. So most bees are actually not eusocial. They're most of them are solitary. And then it's the same thing with wasps. I think it's like two or three origins of eusociality in wasps, but the vast majority of wasps are not eusocial as well. So like we tend to think about like the social bees and the social wasps, because mostly those are the ones that we interact with. And again, because of like that human bias, I think, towards more being interested in social organisms. But when it comes to the entirety of Hymenoptera, which is what ants, bees, and wasps are part of, there were a whole bunch of independent origins of eusociality, but most of the species within Hymenoptera are not eusocial.
So that's a convergence. They're all coming up with the same solution.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. But could it not be the case? Like, I know you've just told us the answer, but why is it not the case that, say, like the parasitic wasps and the majority of the bees, they just lost their eusociality?
Well, so that's the thing. They didn't lose that eusociality. They more retained that ancestral state of not being eusocial. And so there are a bazillion, it's a very strong, this is a very big debate, obviously, what exactly are the conditions that drive the origins of eusociality. Is it intrinsic? So conditions such as like kin selection, genetic relatedness, extrinsic factors. So for example, there's a line of thought that suggests that basically if you tend to be in extremely enclosed, tight-knit spaces, that tends to promote eusociality, and it gets very acrimonious. You know, if you look up the papers that are related to the eusociality debate, it gets pretty crazy. But the general thing, I think, that you're looking at with eusociality is that obviously it's great if you have it. I mean, ants, bees, and wasps that are eusocial have spread all over the planet. They're extraordinarily successful. Termites are extraordinarily successful. They've retained that eusociality for millions and millions of years, but it's very difficult to get going on eusociality. And so I think that there's kind of like this sort of activation energy that you have to overcome. And like that's just sort of me speculating, really. But this sort of activation energy that you have to overcome. And then once you are eusocial, I don't think that there's even that we know of yet any records of animals losing eusociality. So once you're in it, it's a very stable state, or it's very, very difficult to revert.
Yeah, it sounds kind of hard to get started off. Like, you just got to one day be like, oh, I'll just have 10,000 babies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, insects aren't, which is unfair, many insects do, but insects aren't exactly known for their parental care, so.
Mm. And I will have to control all of my children. control. Control by the queen is the queen, like, you know, properly residing over, like, is she the mastermind of the whole nest, or is she just like another cog in the machine?
She's really just another cog in the machine. So the way that these castes work is essentially it's just division of labor. And so we call the ant queen a queen just because of like a quirk of our language, really. But it just means that she is in control of producing tons and tons of babies. But she does not, you know, instruct the other workers in what to do. She is not controlling the other workers. And in many species, there's actually multiple queens in a nest. So there are multiple queens that are reproducing, and sometimes not even just one nest, but many, many nests. And one of the most invasive ants on the planet, depending on your definition, but is essentially one massive mega colony of all of these ants across the planet being one part of this one mega colony. So we tend to have this thought of ants as being like one nest, one queen, but that's not in fact like the most typical way that ants reproduce and divide labor up in the colony.
Okay, that's really interesting. Would it be better if we like moved away from calling them queens to just being like a brooding caste or like a reproducer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would definitely be more accurate. It doesn't sound quite as elegant as queen for sure. So I think that that's probably a good chunk of why we've held on to it for so long. Mm. But yeah, because it tends to, when you say ant queen, it tends to get people thinking, oh, like she rules the colony, and she doesn't. That's not how ant societies work. It's this division of labor, and the reproductive caste just happens to be a lot less numerous and morphologically distinct. And so, and also, of course, because of her role in reproducing, the workers tend to her, they bring her food and they protect her. And, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on making sure that the queen survives. So I think that that's also part of why that sort of idea of the queen being so important came from. Yeah. Because she is incredibly important, she's just not a ruler.
Okay. And do you feel that that gets misrepresented in the public sphere? Because even I thought she had more of a ruling role, and I'm very happy to find out that she doesn't. It's really interesting. But, you know, like in public view, like the queen's in charge, ants are lovely and friendly and harmless, like in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. They're kind of like a noble, harmless, friendly animal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it definitely is misrepresented. People really tend to think that like the queen is the queen, you know, it's right there in the name. Why wouldn't it be? And yeah, it's tends to be actually very shocking for people to realize that there are a lot of queens in a lot of different nests. And so it's just another role, another form of work in the colony.
Yeah.
The same reason for when you were so horrified that they would eat queens in South and Central America as just a snack. And it's really just another reproductive role.
Okay. And how does ant society function in general. So we've got the different castes. How do they know what rule to do? How is it determined how many of each caste is produced? Do you just get born one day as an ant and you're just like, oh, I'm bigger than the rest. I guess I'll just protect everyone. Like, I don't know how it works.
That's a great question. And so I'm actually probably not the best person to ask for this because that's not really the area that I study, but I can tell you some stuff about it. So when it comes to division of labor within the colony, there's been a lot of research on how strict is that division of labor. So like, does a worker, like you said, like basically it close, hatch one day and say, okay, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. Or do they switch roles over time? And for some species, the workers do sort of retain that job for a prolonged time. And in some species, they switch. So there are roles such as like, we call them nurses. So they're looking after the brood. They're feeding the brood. They're cleaning the brood, making sure that the brood is okay. There are foragers. So they are going out to basically find the food. And that's a more dangerous job. So there are some indicators that basically it's also related to the age of the workers. So as they get older, they go out and forage, because if you lose an older worker while foraging, it's not as bad for the colony. You know, like they're about to die anyways. So if they get eaten by a bird while they're trying to find some seeds, then, well. When it comes to the castes that you see, so like castes such as the soldier castes, the major castes that are very morphologically distinct, this is differentiated during the reproductive stages. So this isn't something that, like, you know, they grow into. The pupae, the larvae, they are going to become that major. They are programmed to become that major, as opposed to being programmed to become a minor worker. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. Is it kind of like in the food that they're given, or like hormones in the area that will change how they develop?
Yes. Yeah. It's partially food and partially hormones. And again, like I'm not an expert in this area. Somebody, could definitely tell you a little bit more about the hormonal aspect of this reproduction, but yes, it's a combination of factors.
Right. So evolution, then. we could just do a whole podcast on modern ants, but let's get into the point of it being paleo. So are they a monophyletic group? PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupcher, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. But the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content. And thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.